Friday edition of the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Durrett. I'm out here every Monday and Friday. Jim Fetzer comes on Tuesdays through Thursdays to spread disinformation. But what you hear from me is pure 100% information. Yes, today we're talking political information. Truth in Politics, what a concept. It's a show devoted to political campaigns, not those bogus presidential campaigns that mean nothing, where the two major parties that are bought and paid for by the powers that be, the big international banking interests and their allies, just get up there and dance the dance they're told to dance. No, we're talking about honest-to-goodness, genuine political campaigns, including my own, which you can find out about at BarrettForCongress.us. And a couple of others. First hour, we're going to be talking with another real libertarian. Maybe he would probably say he's even more of a real libertarian than I am. I don't know. He's been at it longer, maybe. His name is David Macko. He's running for Congress in Ohio. His website is Macko for Congress. And he is another good old hard-hitting truth teller and defender of liberty. So it is an honor to welcome my fellow congressional candidate and libertarian cohort, David Macko. Welcome, David. How are you?
Thank you. That's MackoForCongress.com. Excuse me. And you are a real libertarian. I wouldn't question that at all.
No, I try to be. I mean, freedom is what the core political value for me in this country, which was founded on an ideal of freedom from oppressive kings and standing armies and that sort of thing, religious oppression. You know, that's what our identity is really based on. And so it just makes sense to me that that should be expressly the core value that we build our politics around.
Well, I've learned a few things during this campaign. One is the importance of asserting myself. On Monday night, I found out there was a candidates forum Tuesday morning, so I invited myself in, and I got in. Last week, one of our local papers only reported on two of the candidates in my race, and guess which one wasn't. So I sent them a letter, a paper, and I won't mention the name because they have repented. They've done a good job. I said, it's part of the Republicrat duopoly, the corrupt Republican duopoly. Well, the editor got the reporter to call me, and it was one of the best articles I've ever seen. I would use it as campaign literature if I had more time. So we have to assert ourselves. That's the most important thing, and not compromise. You know, the enemy are international banksters. Bernanke and Paulson should be tried for treason. Bush, of course, should be tried for treason, war crimes, and murder. You know, the people respect you more if you stand, take a firm stand, and don't pussyfoot around. That's what I do. You know, some won't like you, but what the heck.
Well, that's my style, too.
I know,
I've never
I know.
Been accused of pussyfooting around.
That's why I endorsed you and why you endorsed me.
Right, yeah, I don't really understand these people who are just always, you know, insisting on being mealy-mouthed. And some of them will sort of admit that we're right about things, but they just don't think it's good politics to say these things. I think it is good politics.
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out Tuesday. I'm looking forward to a good solid 2%. I figure Michael Bednarik got 3.4% in 2006, and he had a good deal more name recognition than I do, since he was a former candidate for president, and he had several hundred thousand dollars more in campaign funds than I do, and he also has had a very good personality. So if I get two, I'll be happy. I think I want to do this again. We got on in Ohio very late. The federal judge didn't rule us on the ballot till the very end of July, and it was September by the time we really got going.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a smart move to build for, you know, a couple of years in advance. I mean, it almost would be smart to just keep right on running right on through the election. I don't know whether I'll do that. I've got some family issues I need to clear up. But I urge other people, including my listeners, if you're listening to this show, you're smart enough to run for Congress. You know what the key issues are. You should start thinking about 2010 right now.
Yeah, just don't compromise. Speak the truth. If you're running for the federal Congress, feel free to go to my website and just change the picture and the biographical information.
There you go.
No, seriously. Oh, one other thing I learned. Paul Conroy is the Libertarian candidate for Congress in the 10th District of Ohio, which is the western side of Cleveland and suburbs. Don't have another candidate do your website. It hurts both campaigns. But he did a great job, though.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, figuring out how to do a website and how to pay for it, and that's all.
Yeah.
Hey, there are these logistical things, and again, that's why it's smart to get started early.
Oh yes. Well, we couldn't because we had, like I said, we didn't get on the ballot till the end of July. One other point I want to make before we go further: sometimes people tell us that the Libertarian Party is a debating society, and that we waste too much of our time doing that. Have you ever heard that?
Well, once or twice.
Okay. Let me tell you, it helped. It's good practice to be in the debating society when you attend candidates' nights or actual debates, because the average libertarian is probably about 10 or 15 points higher IQ than the average American, and if you can debate and discuss things with fellow libertarians, you're going to do very well with the general public or against them if necessary.
Well, that's been my experience. You know, I had a really tough debate against Rolf Lindgren, who will be coming on the show at 5 o'clock. He's my second guest today. Rolf at that time was very, very hard, dead set against 9/11 truth. He just, you know, thought that was a bunch of crazy stuff. So I went to the Libertarian Party meeting, and Rolf took me on, and we had a just ball to the wall, heavy, high energy debate, which Rolf, you know, really didn't want to listen too much. You know, Rolf likes to do the talking more than the listening. But it planted some seeds, and it kind of wasn't that many months later that he started looking into it, and the minute he saw Building 7 come down and saw there was no explanation for that, he turned around. And so after, you know, winning that debate with Rolf, I think that kind of built up my debating muscles. And I just had a great debate on Tuesday with Ron Kind and Paul Stark, my two opponents. A lot of people told me I did real well. People who, you know, they said, well, I don't agree with you, Kevin. You know, I didn't know anything about you before this, but you did great. So I heard that from a bunch of people. And I kind of wish that debate had a bigger audience. I think I'd pick up a lot of votes.
I was at the Cleveland City Club yesterday debating against my Republican and Democrat opponents. Finally got both of them together at once. Well, most of the people I've talked to are more friendly to me, but they said I did well, so.
Yeah, well, you know, running on a libertarian truth-telling platform, you know, when you're speaking the truth, it makes it easy. You don't have to be brilliant. You don't have to be eloquent. You know, I mean, I was up against Ron Kind, who was a whole lot slicker than me. He's an Obama-type, really slick speaker. But because I was telling the truth, I didn't have to think too hard, you know.
Well,
another
thing, even a lot of libertarians have websites that are sort of generic, but if you notice mine, macoforcongress.com, it goes into pretty much detail on almost everything. I tried to cover practically everything that would come up. And that, together with having a set of principles and belief in the Constitution as it was written, makes it very easy to answer all these questionnaires that come up.
Well, that's right. You've got a complete platform, and it's coherent.
No.
It all hangs together.
No.
Yep, I tried to do the same thing, and that's libertarians are good at that.
You did.
We'll be back in a bit. This is Kevin Darrett. I'm talking with David Macko of MackoForCongress.com. Return in just a moment, so stick around.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
Welcome back.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
This is the Dynamic Duo Show, right here on GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett, and today we're talking politics for the full 2 hours. I've got candidates on the line. Ted Burleson, a Wisconsin Assembly candidate, will be coming on later on. Rolf Lindgren, the campaign manager at BarrettForCongress.us, will be coming on. Right now, we're talking to David Macko He's from MacoForCongress.com, Libertarian candidate for Congress in Ohio, and he's a truth teller after my own heart. David, you said, you know, you're not afraid of controversy, neither am I. You know, one of my most controversial platforms has never really been reported on much in the media, which is kind of surprising to me. And but it finally made it into a daily paper in today's Altoona Star up in Altoona, Wisconsin, which is sort of the sister city of Eau Claire, only a little smaller than Eau Claire. They published this series, you know, series of my answers to their questions, and one of them is that we need to arrest all the key Zionist lobby operatives as undeclared agents of a foreign power.
I second that.
So Congress can go back to representing the American people rather than the extremist fringe in Israel.
I second that.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine that there are some folks who aren't going to like that too much, but, you know, unfortunately, the truth hurts sometimes. And it's the truths that hurt that are the ones that we need to be telling the most, because
they're
the ones that are crucial.
We're on the verge of World War III. You know, it's long past time to be overly sensitive or overly polite. And besides, according to my copy of the Constitution, we're both running for a job to represent the American people, the people of the United States. Now, if I was running for the Israeli Knesset, or if you were running for the Israeli Knesset, I'm sure, since we're honorable people, we would put their interests first. But since we're running for the U.S. Congress, I'm putting America's interests first, and obviously by your statement just now, you are too.
Well, I sure am. I had Grant Smith on this show about, what, several months ago. He has a book out called Foreign Agents, and it describes the development of the Israeli lobby in this country. It used to be called the World Zionist Congress, and it was operated out of Israel by the government of Israel, and they had to declare themselves to be agents of a foreign power, which means they had to report everything they did, including all of their financial transactions, to the U.S. government and make that available, you know, for people to see. And they had to be transparent. And so what they then decided to do was to go stealth. And so they transformed their operation into things like AIPAC and its many sister organizations, and they all claim that they're not agents of a foreign power, even though they obviously are, and so they're not filing. And as Grant Smith points out, they basically are illegal, undeclared agents of a foreign power. And I think a good way to put an end to this would be to step in there and arrest them and put them on trial. I mean, I'm not saying you have to lock them up for life or anything, but just to send a signal that we're not going to tolerate this anymore, because our policy has been so distorted by the power of this lobby. And, you know, the Iraq War never would have happened without this lobby. Maybe 9/11 wouldn't have, too. We don't know. So, you know, we've really gotten into some serious hot water because our foreign policy making has been taken over by another country that has different interests from ours.
Mearsheimer and Walt did a good job, too. The Israeli lobby and U.S. foreign policy is a great book.
They sure did, and they made a real splash. And I think they helped make it respectable, or at least, you know, a non-hanging offense to talk about these things in public.
Do you remember earlier in the year, when the enemy was going through some of Ron Paul's newsletters of the 1990s, and in one of them they claimed to find statements about the Israeli lobby? I think the response to that charge was incorrect. I think the response to that charge should have been, well, whoever wrote that newsletter back in the early 1990s was prophetic. He's been proven to be absolutely correct by Mearsheimer and Walt's book, by the book you just mentioned, which I do want to get to read as soon as possible, too. And again, you need to take a strong, proactive response. The tendency is always to have us back off. That's what the enemy wants.
Well, yeah, that's true. And so often is that, that line from the Yeats poem goes, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And it seems like that, you know, that situation just has been replaying itself out over and over. People with some decency and some ideals just can't bring themselves to get in there and fight hard and speak the truth powerfully and honestly.
Well, there are a few exceptions, and I hope the people listening to us realize who they are.
Right. And unfortunately, they're not the major party candidates for office in most cases, although Dennis Kucinich is still, you know, he's still making the right kinds of noises. I don't know if you saw his call for a 9/11 Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yes, he is quite good on the war. I mentioned Paul Conroy, our candidate in the 10th District. He is running against Congressman Kucinich, but obviously Kucinich is absolutely right on the war.
Well, right. He's not only right on the war, but, you know, now he's put out this public call for a 9/11 Truth and Reconciliation Commission that, if you read it and you realize that he knows 9/11 is an inside job. I mean, it, you know, virtually says it. It says that, you know, we need the truth about this to heal our country and so on and so forth. And, you know, I think that's a good approach for him. Personally, I find it hard to, you know, to start jumping up and down and cheering for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for a crime of this magnitude when the perpetrators are still running the country.
doesn't reconciliation mean that everyone will be better reconciled when the traitors are hanged? That's fine. See,
maybe we finally have a radio, and I've gotten in trouble for it. They've been lynch mobs on my trail ever since I used the word scaffold once talking about this.
Maybe we have a little difference of opinion here. Finally, after an hour and a half, or 2 hours last time, and a half hour this time. One other thing I was going to say regarding the truth in general. You can tell who controls a country by whom it is not possible to criticize.
Absolutely.
Think about that,
You're here.
Think about it.
That's right. And that's where you start to really wonder about, you know, there are these taboos. What, you know, why do these taboos exist? You know, why can't you talk about the Israeli lobby? You know, and it's here's an issue that all of my 9/11 truth friends, or most of them, would rather that never got talked about. But the issue of these so-called Holocaust deniers getting arrested and imprisoned for saying what may be stupid and wrong things about history.
Well, what may be accurate and correct things.
Well, you know, you don't know until you look into it, and I haven't had time to go and study that issue myself, and so, you know, I don't know any more about that than I do about most of the other Holocaust and genocides in history, but
right.
I found that even just saying what I just said is enough for people to start yelling, oh, he's a Holocaust agnostic, burn him at the stake. I'm like, what? You know,
read David Irving, and there's another interesting website by John Bryant, Birdman Bryant.
Well, you sound like more of a Holocaust agnostic than me. You sound like a skeptic. And that would be okay. It's not a crime to have a different opinion, and especially if those are opinions that they try to throw you in jail for having. We need free speech. We'll be back in a moment. Kevin Barrett and David Macko exercising our First Amendment right of free speech.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Dynamic Duo Show. You're listening to GCNLive.com, and I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm talking today with David Macko of MackoForCongress.com, another hard-hitting libertarian truth-teller who doesn't care what you think. He calls it the way he sees it, and I totally endorse that. I've also endorsed David Macko's campaign for Congress. He has endorsed me, and let's hope we both win, or at least break our 2% threshold of expectation.
I do care what people think. I'd like them to gain enough knowledge and understanding of principles to think what's correct and the truth.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well,
I guess
think
that,
as
what
we
I
do,
meant,
actually.
That, you're not cringing in shame that there are some people who get angry when you say these things.
That's their problem.
Right.
Getting back to the Holocaust, first of all, I want to say I'm prejudiced. I'm of Carpatho-Russian descent, and I'm prejudiced against Hitler. If he had treated the Slavic peoples halfway decently, he could have overthrown the Bolsheviks. Okay. Secondly, I have to ask this question. You know, there are still people around who believe the earth is flat. None of them are being arrested. None of them are being killed. None of them are being fired from their jobs. If the official version of the Holocaust is so well established, why are so many Holocaust revisionists facing prison or revilement or being fired from their jobs?
That's a very good question.
Yeah. And also, if Hitler was a socialist, a national socialist, as such, he was a criminal and responsible for deaths. He should have been tried and executed. Okay. But there's still a lot of questions. Were you aware that there was a monument at Auschwitz? And that monument used to refer to the 4.5 million deaths which were supposed to have taken place there. Were you aware that the figure was changed to 1.5 million from 4.5 million?
Yes, I did learn that.
Don Bryant's website, yeah.
Right, I learned that. The only book on this issue I've read is a book that is, it's by that guy from Skeptic magazine, what's his name, Michael Shermer. He's a big anti-9/11 truth propagandist. But he wrote this book, Why Do They Deny the Holocaust? So that's pretty much the only thing I know about Holocaust deniers. I read that not too long ago now. And in that book, he does mention this, that this is true, that in fact they you know, went down by more than 3 million people in their estimate of people killed at Auschwiz, which is quite extraordinary.
But the 6 million figure never changed.
The 6 million figure didn't change at all.
The term you used, Holocaust denier, that's a concoction of the enemy. There's no one who disagrees that Holocausts took place in the 20th century. 20 of them or 25, there's a book, Death by Government, by R.J. Rummel. Another interesting question that people might want to think about is that why is one of the Holocausts, whether you accept the 6 million figure or some other figure, why is that Holocaust given 99% of the attention and the other 20 or two dozen Holocausts of the 20th century given about 1% of the attention?
Well, that's a really good question. And, you know, actually, I think I have a little bit of an answer. And, part of the answer, of course, is that it's been used to drum up support for the otherwise indefensible establishment of Israel.
Exactly correct.
Right. And then there's also another reason, though, that's more subtle than that. And this comes out of there's a book called Exterminate All the Brutes by a Swedish guy. I think his name is Sven Lindqvist. And this book goes into the history of the European genocides and holocausts of non-European peoples, beginning roughly 500 years ago, and becoming really a big time just in this past, just a century ago. And so I think that part of the reason why the Nazi Holocaust gets all the attention is that the victims of the Nazi Holocaust, especially the Jews, have been deemed in retrospect to be honorary Europeans, whereas the people all over the world, including most of the inhabitants of the Americas, Australia, New Zealand, many groups in Africa, these people who were in many cases successfully, completely exterminated, whole peoples were successfully genocided. And those people don't get any attention because deep down inside there is this prejudice against non-Europeans. And the Jews used to be considered Semitic. You know, that's where the anti-Semitic term came from. In the 19th century, they were believed to be racially from this so-called Semitic group from the Middle East. And that's why they were persecuted, is because they were considered less than fully human because they weren't European. But then, post-World War II, the Jews were, in retrospect, granted honorary European status, and this genocide within Europe, oh, my God, how terrible. In this advanced country in Europe, they kill people that, you know, who cares about the Europeans going and butchering and exterminating, tens or hundreds of millions of people around the world who weren't European. When they did this thing inside Europe, suddenly that becomes the big focus.
Well, of course, the Aztecs did it pretty good job of genociding their neighbors. They're sacrificial massacres to their gods. 40,000 people were massacred in 3 days in some of their ceremonies. So
that's true. It isn't just the Europeans.
No, it's every. You know, let's face it. It's everyone.
Our so-called civilization is actually built on this. What civilization really is somebody figures out how to organize a gang of thugs who can go and steal the surplus food from the peasants and build an army of, an even bigger army of thugs.
Government 101. Government 101.
Yeah. Yeah, so, what are we going to do about this? Well, hopefully we can learn from our past mistakes, right?
And apply libertarian principles that you don't steal your neighbor's food or his horses or cows or wives. You don't kill your neighbors.
Well, that's something I like about the Libertarian Party is this non-initiation of force. Talking about force and fraud are the two cardinal sins of libertarianism. I pretty much agree with that.
Of course, any rational people should.
Right.
The world would be a much better place if it were applied.
Right.
And even though many libertarians come from a non-theistic perspective, I at one time shook up a libertarian by saying, well, the non-aggression principle is pretty much like the Christian golden rule.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
It's maybe not going quite as far as turning the other cheek, though.
No.
Because libertarians do often believe in the right to self-defense.
Oh, yes, I do that.
So, but... Yeah, there's some version of the golden rule, I think, in just about all cultures.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And if people could keep that in mind, I think we'd have a lot easier time of it.
We certainly would. We would have a lot less wars. Well, like Smedley Butler, one of the great Marine Corps generals of the early 20th century, said, unless you're fighting for your home or for the Bill of Rights, war is a racket.
Right, and people sort of instinctively know this. There's a sort of built-in, aspect of our humanity that makes most of us not want to fight to aggress on somebody else's territory, but which makes us capable of fighting to defend our own territory. And a lot of animal species are like this, too. The defender of the territory in territorial species always has a big advantage. Even if the aggressor is bigger and tougher, the defender usually wins.
This is true, and Jefferson said that mankind are more likely to put up with the evils of government than to revolt.
Okay, well, let's get some revolt going, folks. There's plenty of government evil to go around these days. We'll be back in a bit. This is Kevin Barrett, Libertarian candidate for Congress, talking with my fellow Libertarian candidate for Congress, David Macko. Stick around.
Hey, Jude. Don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey, Jude.
Welcome back.
Don't be afraid.
This is the Dynamic Duo Show on GCNLive.com, and you're listening to a couple of Libertarian congressional candidates. I'm Kevin Barrett, and my guest today is David Macko of MackoForCongress.com. Well, David, I just saw that people can see some excerpts from my debate with incumbent pro-war anti-Constitution Democrat Ron Kind and Republican neocon theocrat challenger Paul Stark. It happened at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, on Tuesday, and you can see the excerpts at one of my very favorite websites, which is RadioDuJour.com. For those of you who don't speak French, that's radio, then DUJOUR.com.
Any particular area I should go to when I get there?
Well, it's actually the front page story for today.
Good.
We just click on that, and hopefully it'll have a link to the full debate. Ooh, it looks like maybe it doesn't. But that'll be linked at my website soon.
The City Club debate's not on yet, unfortunately. And I don't know if it will be on anywhere on the Internet as one total item.
Yeah, one of the nice things about having this debate at a university was the university AV department taped it and put it up on the web. So So that was nice.
Oh, yeah. I attended a real presidential debate yesterday, also at the Cleveland City Club where I spoke at noon. The real debate was among Bob Barr, Chuck Baldwin, and Ralph Nader, also at the City Club at 4:30 to 5:30.
And all three of those guys would get my vote, in one case probably will get my vote. Well, Cynthia McKinney's still in the running.
She was invited too, but she couldn't make it.
Oh, that's too bad, yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty good crop of third-party candidates, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
Kind of pathetic that we have this election where so many people have been brainwashed into thinking that it really matters.
Could I explain instant runoff voting quickly to your listeners?
Oh, yeah, we need that,
okay,
don't
here's
we?
Here's how it goes. Say there are six candidates running. For example, my first choice would be Bob Barr. My second would be Chuck Baldwin. My third would be either Cynthia McKinney or Ralph Nader. And fourth would be the other one. Fifth would be Satan. And then after that, McBama or McSame.
Okay, and how would your vote then count more than it does now?
Because if my first choice failed, all my votes for my second choice would then count.
I see. Okay.
This would end the whole hoax about throwing our vote away.
Well, that's a great point. Yeah, that's
instant runoff voting is very important. Google it for Google mm-hmm. it. Instant runoff voting. Could I basically review the four most important things we need to do for our listeners?
Go for
one,
it.
One, get rid of the Federal Reserve System.
You're here.
Support Ron Paul's bill. Repeal the legal tender laws and let people have transactions in gold, silver, and other precious metals without taxes. Two, the Liberty Amendment to get rid of all federal lands and other property not constitutionally held and repeal the personal income, gift, and death tax. Three, get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan, get out of the whole rest of the world. And this may be controversial with some people. I'd say put the troops on the southern border for the real invasion.
Okay, so that's is that three or four?
That was three so far.
That's three so far, okay.
And the fourth one would, let's see, what was the fourth one? My gosh, I'm getting tired. I was out distributing literature. Energy, of course. Get rid of all federal taxes and regulations on the production of energy and abolish the Department of Energy and bring Lindsey Williams to Washington so he can tell how he witnessed the discovery of a 200-year oil supply at Gull Island when he was chaplain of the pipeline.
Really? Okay.
Sorry for being embarrassing folks out there, but I have been quite busy the last several days.
Oh, I believe it. I know we're coming into the home stretch, and I'm feeling a little under the weather here myself. But hey, we've only got a few more days left. Got to keep chugging ahead. Well, you know, I like that platform. I don't know if I totally would put everything there in the same order of priorities, but I'll tell you, I would definitely put abolish the Fed. Get honest money at the top of my list of priorities too, because that's kind of the root of all evil, isn't it?
Well, it started the first Great Depression. It's starting the second now. It's robbed the American people of 99% of the value of the dollar since 1913. It's a huge, huge crime against every American.
It is, and it's unsustainable. There's no way that they can possibly keep lending, privately lending the whole money supply into existence at interest. Where's the money going to come from to pay back the interest? So it's inflationary. The bankers are the house in this gambling casino, so they just keep raking it in, getting richer and richer, and that tempts them to set up governments behind the scenes, secret governments, and it seems to me that the real government now is the secret government.
You're right. America, Freedom to Fascism is an excellent movie to see on that subject. It's on the Internet. G. Edward Griffin's book, Creature from Jekyll Island.
It's a great book.
Eustace Mullins' book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve. I recommend all three.
I haven't read that one yet. Now, wasn't Eustace Mullins like somehow connected with Ezra Pound?
Yes.
Okay.
He was a protege of Ezra Pound.
Right. You know, I've read some of Pound's poetry, and I haven't delved deeply into his politics. Of course, he's very controversial. Supposedly in the English departments, at least. But you say Mullins wrote a great book on the Federal Reserve?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Haven't read it yet, but I hope to get to it. I'm playing catch up on this. Frankly, you know, David, I didn't know most of this stuff, five years ago.
That shows what our educational system is.
Well, that's right. I had three MAs and a PhD, and I still didn't know most of this stuff.
Well, as important as the Federal Reserve System and the income tax are to get rid of, if I had my choice, I'd get rid of the government schools first, because you'd have enough intelligent people to solve the Federal Reserve problem and the income tax problem in 10 or 15 years. Whereas if you got rid of the Federal Reserve tomorrow morning, as wonderful as that would be, and got rid of the income tax, but kept the government schools, they'd put another con job on the American people. Well,
so what's the best model for education, David?
Private schools, home schools, anything but government schools. The first government schools were in Prussia after the Napoleonic Wars, because they wanted good, well-trained soldiers who would be able to fight back.
So, and here in the USA, they took that model and they used it to indoctrinate immigrants into a dumbed-down version of what it means to be American.
And then the rest of us.
They got a pretty dumbed-down country on their hands.
Well, yeah, you'll see that Tuesday, most likely, unless something really good happens.
Yeah, you know, I keep keeping my fingers crossed that something really good will happen. You know, 9/11 truth will suddenly break out and the whole electoral system will topple over somehow. Who knows?
To end on a positive note, all we have to do is prove to the American people that they have been lied to by their government in one area, 9/11 being the latest choice, probably the best choice since it's the most recent. If we can do that, if we can get them to understand that the government lies to them, the government is their enemy, if we can get them to understand that the establishment media lies to them and the establishment media is their enemy, then we'll win.
Well, I'm doing my part to try to get that message
across.
I
know you are, and thank you for having me on.
Well, hey, it's been great to have you, David. As always, we'll have to have you back sometime after the election and do a rehash.
Sure. Okay. I'll come on once a month if it doesn't drive your listeners away.
Well, so far I'm getting good reviews on you, so I think we should maybe have you back next month.
Okay.
I'm
willing.
Okay. Well, We'll be looking forward to it. Why don't you give the listeners your website one more time?
That's macoforcongress.com, macoforcongress.com.
All right. Well, another uncommon politician, statesman, truth teller.
Same here.
Somebody who's not afraid of taking the hard position on the important issues. Somebody's calling attention to the great crimes of our time. David Macko. Well, thanks, David. It's been great.
You're welcome.
Take care. Okay, we'll be talking more electoral politics in the second hour. Rolf Lindgren, the campaign advisor here at BarrettForCongress.us, will be coming on for the first half hour of the next hour. And then we'll bring on Ted Burleson, a Wisconsin Assembly candidate, a fellow libertarian, another truth-telling lover of liberty. So that should be great. We'll be back in just a bit. Stay tuned. Okay, we're back once again at the Dynamic Duo Show right here at GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Barrett, and today I'm talking with people who are involved in electoral politics. You know, many folks in the 9/11 truth movement are just not that politically savvy. And one of the ways many of them are not politically savvy is not having the nuts and bolts skills to deal with electoral politics. And I suppose that's okay. That's the way of the world. We have a lot of idealists in the 9/11 truth movement. A lot of very smart people, folks like David Ray Griffin, who recently, just today, sent me an email saying that he just spoke to a standing-room-only crowd in Kobe, Japan. So go David. He's over there for some serious 9/11 truth work in Japan, where Yukihisa Fujita has been pressing the 9/11 truth issue repeatedly in the Japanese parliament. David, I think, is the most effective of the 9/11 scholars. We have a lot of other good scholars, too. We have a lot of great people, but we don't have a lot of people who are really experienced in electoral politics and public relations. And fortunately, there are a few, and one of them is my guest this half hour. It is Rolf Lindgren. He's currently the campaign advisor at BarrettForCongress.us. He's a longtime Libertarian Party stalwart, and nobody's ever accused him of being the kind of pussy-footing kind of person either, which is a rare combination. Somebody knows how to do politics and PR, and he doesn't pussyfoot around. So he's also a Galileo scholar and a lot of other things, but rather than ranting about him for the whole hour, let's just bring him on. Rolf Lindgren, welcome to the show. How are you, Rolf?
Good afternoon, Kevin. Good to be here again.
Hey, it's always good to bring you on. What's happening at that Barrett for Congress campaign with that crazy guy Barrett who's running for Congress in Wisconsin?
Well, Barrett's been doing a lot of stuff. He just got endorsed in the newspaper, in a real newspaper, the La Crosse Tribune, I believe it was in, by David Ray Griffin, Kevin Ryan, Carol
Brie.
And there was one other person on there. Who was the
Colonel
other person?
Robert Bowman.
Oh, Colonel Robert Bowman.
Of the space weapons program.
And I just got an email from Webster Tarpley. He says he endorses your campaign as well.
Hey, good for Webster. I was on his show again today, so I guess, you know, it's better late than never. Webster's the one who pushed me into running in the first place.
Of course, you've already been endorsed by Jesse Ventura. I see your station is running Jesse Ventura ads during the breaks. It sounds like Jesse Ventura is endorsing Dean Barkley for Senate in Minnesota.
He sure is.
And Dean Barkley, is he an independent or is he a libertarian?
I think he's an independent.
Okay, he's an independent, but he's definitely a libertarian-leaning libertarian. See, he's what you call a big-tent libertarian.
Well, that's pretty much kind of what I am too, Rolf. I mean,
exactly.
We need a big tent, you know, or we're going to end up getting 2% every election.
Well, the thing you have to figure out is you have to have a big tent. You have to figure out a way not to water down what you're really all about. Because if obviously the Democrats and Republicans have a big tent, but so we don't want a tent that big. So on the other hand, we want a tent that's bigger than you get 1% of the vote. You know.
Yeah, I guess we, you know, I would like to have a big tent for truth. I mean, I would like to have people, you know, figure it out and you know, get on the right side of some of these things. Not the issues that are really a matter of values, but some, the ones that are a matter of facts, you know, where you can just clearly say that, you know, factually this is the way it is. You know, for instance, factually our military budget is about offense, not defense. So let's, you know, factually take a look at how much would we spend and how would we spend it if we were going to actually just defend our borders. And these are the kinds of things that should be no-brainers. There's not a lot of room for argument with the values there. Of course, if your values are that you want to go out invading other people's countries, that's very interesting. But that's not the values of most people.
Yeah, well, what you want to try to do is pick issues that have popular support or the potential for popular support that are not being addressed by the Republicrats, the two old parties. Now, a good start for that was the Ron Paul Third Party Coalition, where certain issues were singled out that all of the major third parties agreed with. The three biggest third parties are, of course, the Libertarian Party, which is a centrist party. The left-wing party is the Green Party. And the right-wing party is the Constitution Party. And then there's also Ralph Nader, who's an independent. If you can find an issue that all the third parties agree with, it's usually something that has popular support and isn't being addressed by the Republicrats. And I believe that your campaign has done some polling, and according to your polling, one of those issues is the bailout. 59% of the people in the United States, and our poll may have had a smaller number than even other polls, was 59% opposed the bailout. Another issue that most third-party candidates agree on are term limits for Congress. We had 76% agreed with that. Another issue was, should third-party and independent candidates be invited to televised debates? And 76% of the people in the country think that's a good idea. And obviously the Republicans, you know, sometimes in Congress you can get into a debate, but for president they don't let you into any debates. And those are the ones that really get the attention. And then another one was ballot access. All over the country, many third parties, libertarians, greens, have trouble getting on the ballot. And 79% of the people think that ballot access should be made easier for alternative candidates. So those are just some of the issues. Obviously, the war spending is a big one. Medical marijuana is another issue. That all the third party candidates think that medical marijuana should be re-legalized.
So what we really need is almost a third party coalition platform.
Well, the Libertarian Party needs to. I mean, I agree with their economic positions, but what they need to do is they need to be more practical. Some libertarians have already done this, like Ed Thompson.
Right.
Ran for governor in 2002 in Wisconsin, the brother of Tommy Thompson. He ran as a libertarian, but he didn't say, you know, end all taxes or something like that. He was a strong advocate for lowering taxes. And that's what a libertarian needs to do, is call for lowering taxes, because you can't get rid of all the taxes right away. The whole society would be in turmoil. Remember, it took us since 1913, we've had 95 years of income taxes. So to get rid of a tax that's been established for 95 years may take more than 1 year or 4 years or even 8 years. It shouldn't take 95 years to get rid of it, but it's going to take more than 1 year to get rid of the income tax. But we can reduce income taxes, you know, right away, or freeze taxes, things like that. And you have to have someone who has nuts and bolts numbers and knows the numbers. Someone like a Bob Barr is a good example of a libertarian. He's the presidential candidate. He knows all the nuts and bolts of how Congress works, so he knows what can be done and what's a little bit too utopian.
And that's one of the good points for Bob Barr. And there are several, as well as some less good points. But vote for Bob Barr over any of those major party candidates for sure. We'll be back in a bit. Kevin Derrick with Rolf Lindgren.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Don't you know that you can count me out?
Don't you know it's gonna be
alright? Alright. Alright.
Welcome back to Truth Revolution Radio. Well, no, that's actually been trademarked by my competition. So let's just call it the Dynamic Duo Show. I'm Kevin Derrick. I'm talking with DerrickForCongress.us campaign advisor Rolf Lindgren. And Rolf, I agree with you on your overall take on what we need to do to get the third party movement off the ground. And I also agree that the Libertarian Party is supposed to be in the center of the political spectrum. And I agree that that means that we need to take it easy on the ultra-radical economic proposals, especially at a time when people are feeling economically insecure, when there's talk of a new Great Depression on the horizon. You talk about a Great Depression and people think of FDR and the government intervening to help ordinary people out. You don't really think of cutting the government out of the social safety net. And so I think at this time in history, this is a terrible time for libertarians to be too dogmatic about total, you know, eliminating government from the economy, and rather to talk common sense about how to attenuate people's suffering and maybe gradually reduce government's role in the economy and get it out of those places where it's doing the most harm and the least good, such as military spending.
Okay, well, you got to remember, though, that the Great Depression started in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
And the Depression was still worse, was even worse by in 1937 and 1938. The Depression was still going on. I mean, so the idea that FDR got us out of the Depression, well, yeah, after about, over, it was over 10 years later that we got out of the Depression.
But what's strange about this, Rolf, is that, you know, a lot of economists claim that it was the mobilization for World War II that finally completely pulled us out of the Depression. How do you explain that as a libertarian, that the massive government spending pulled us out of the Depression?
Because the World War II started in 1939, and it started before that, actually, if you count the Japanese. We started selling military stuff to all the other countries that needed weapons when the war started. So that's why we got out of the Depression, because we had a two-year window where we got to sell weapons to other countries, and they were buying weapons from us. That's why we got out of the Depression.
But the argument that government spending kills economies, which I think does have some truth to it, would have a hard time explaining how it is that from, say, 1940 to 1945, when the government just stepped in there and was ham-fisted in its approach to the economy, seized control of the economy, the government sector exploded, and you know, people were, you know, they eliminated sales of private automobiles and other such things. You know, it was a really socialist dictatorship kind of economy for 5 years, and we came out of it much, much richer than we went in.
No, but our economy took off a lot more in 1946 after those things were stopped.
Well, that's true.
Our economy was much stronger in the late 40s than it was in the early 40s, and that's because the government got out. We were making money off the war. Did you watch Zeitgeist?
Oh yeah, of course. But it wasn't just private companies that were making money off the war. It was the government stepped in and basically took over a lot of the economy.
Yeah, but the economy turned around after the war started in 1939 because we had a 2 year window where we could sell weapons all over the world and bring money into our wealth flow to the United States from other countries.
Okay, I'll agree with that.
Years.
I think that had a lot to do with it. I'm just kind of, you know, rehashing what I learned in my American economic history.
Yeah, well, what about the panic of 1819? The government didn't do anything. We got out of that panic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was when James Monroe was the president. We didn't have a very developed economy in 1819, so there's even more need for the government than now. We already have a giant economy. We don't need the government to help the economy anymore. There's all kind. You know how many businessmen there are in the United States? That's who helps the economy, is businessmen and people working. You know, we have a, in 1819, the panic of 1819, that was solved because James Monroe just sat around and said, no, this is unconstitutional. And then by the time people were arguing about the panic, and by the time they were done arguing about the panic was already over. He signed a bill in 1820 that had a very modest effect on anything. And that's it.
So I guess
the same with
the
panic of 1837.
Hopefully, if we argue long enough, it'll be over. It'll end.
What about all the other panics? There was a panic in 1837. There was a panic in 1873.
Right.
There was a panic in 1893. There was a panic in 1907. None of these panics lasted anywhere near as long as the Great Depression. None of them.
Right. Well, you know, right now, though, Rolf, we're facing a really tough situation. You know, I had Jimmy Walter on my show not too long ago, and he's, you know, I guess he would lean a little bit left on his economic views, and he points out that the root problem is that the actual physical on-the-ground economy, the manufacture of goods, has largely stopped in this country. We exported our entire productive capacity overseas, and we're trying to subsist on trading funny money, that is, green-colored paper, and the threat of military force for actual goods and services that are being produced elsewhere.
I agree with that. I agree with that. And the question is, why is that?
That's a good question.
There's too much government regulation. That's why.
Why?
There's too much regulation.
I don't agree with that. I think that there's a cabal of financial overlords who made a conscious decision to do this as part of their step-by-step plan for world government. But, hey, call me.
Well, indeed, think about this. When the Industrial Revolution started in England in the 1760s, it accelerated the invention of the steam engine. It passed to the northern United States in the early 1800s, especially like New York, which was a gigantic Industrial Revolution. The South was bypassed for the most part for the Industrial Revolution. What happened is that the Industrial Revolution hasn't hit the whole world yet. Third world countries haven't really had an Industrial Revolution, and if they start an Industrial Revolution because of our modern communications and transportation, it's cheaper for third world countries to do the grunge work that no one wants to do around here. You know, how many people want to sit in a shoe factory and make shoes? Not many do here, but they'll do it for less money in third world countries. And we have to keep up with it. The government isn't very good at keeping up with the rest of the world. The government puts all these regulations in as if there's never going to be a change in the economy or the markets. And that's the problem.
I still don't quite understand why American industrial workers were able to get such a relatively high standard of living, say, in the 1950s. When, you know, they had salaries that average salary from the 1950s to now, the average salary would be, well, in terms of keeping up with inflation, it would be over $25 an hour, and it might be double that if it was taking into consideration the gains.
They did. In 1950, you could go to high school and then get married to your sweetheart, and she could stay at home and take care of your 8 kids.
Right.
In the 1950s.
What happened?
Government regulation.
Okay. Spoken like a true libertarian. Well, thank you, Rolf Lindgren, campaign advisor at BarrettForCongress.us. Keep up the good work. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Just anybody.
Help.
You know I need someone.
Help.
When I was younger, so much younger than today,
I never needed
anybody's help in any way.
Now
these days are gone and I'm not so self-assured.
Now I find
I've changed my mind and opened up the doors.
This is the Dynamic Duo Show on GCNLive.com. And I'm Kevin Barrett, talking politics with people experienced in electoral politics today. We had on David Macko, the congressional candidate from Ohio, a fellow libertarian in the first hour. Brought on Rolf Lindgren, a Libertarian Party stalwart in Wisconsin for the beginning of the second hour. And now we're bringing on another libertarian. He's a candidate for the assembly in the 91st district here in Wisconsin, which is actually in my district. That's the district I'm running for Congress in. His name is Ted Burleson. He's got a really good set of principles. He's like most libertarians. He's having trouble getting the mainstream media to cover him, like most of us. And he's still out there slogging away and telling the truth and getting the message out there. So, hey, Ted Burleson, welcome to the Dynamic Duo Show. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, Dr. Barrett.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, when we first connected, you mentioned that you were having a tough time getting taken seriously by the media. And, you know, just recently Channel 19 in La Crosse ran candidate profiles for your race and didn't include you or the independent, Paul Bessler. And, you know, I've had some of these problems, too. I've gotten some coverage, but not always what it should be. What are we going to have to do to get the media to pay attention to candidates who actually talk about the issues and have something to say?
Well, that's a great question. And we were able to make a difference with Channel 19 by having enough people call and leave messages for their news director last night that the first thing this morning my phone rang and they arranged to come to Winona to interview me tomorrow, and they're going to go to Trembolo and interview Mr. Bessler. So I think we're going to get the coverage, even though it's a little late and not, you know, a part of their regular district coverage, but there's certainly a long way to go. We shouldn't have to go to that extreme to get, you know, to get covered the way we should by the free media.
Right. Well, I just had a wake-up call in that department when the Eau Claire Leader Telegram, which has been studiously ignoring my candidacy and not publishing the many dozens of letters in support of it, published an article last week headlined Congressional Candidates Clash on War. And the alleged clash was the two major party candidates, incumbent pro-war Democrat Ron Kind and even more pro-war Republican neocon challenger Paul Stark, both basically agreeing in their support of the war, just maybe disagreeing on, you know, Stark wants to send in hundreds of thousands of more troops and, you know, and completely victory or death. and Kind wants to just, you know, waffle around there for a while and, you know, maybe eventually come home. I mean, two pro-war candidates are supposedly clashing. And here I am, the one anti-war candidate in the race, and they didn't even mention my anti-war position. What kind of article is that?
Sounds pretty bogus to me. I didn't get an opportunity to read that one, but I did watch the debate with you and Congressman Kind and Mr. Stark, and I loved how Mr. Stark said there was a stark difference, but I sure couldn't see one.
No, not a dime's worth of stark difference between Stark and Kind on the important stuff. And if people want to see that debate, you can see my own opening and closing statements archived at RadioDuJour.com. That's Radio DuJour.com, and there's also a link to the entire debate, and I think it's actually a fairly good debate. I managed to get in some hard-hitting truths, and I guess Ron Kind looks kind of miserable at certain points while I'm telling the truth about his accepting bribes disguised as campaign contributions and, you know, being party to war crimes and things like that.
Well, I mean, he should have. He has every reason to look embarrassed about the way some of the things that he's done while in Washington. And I had a hard time listening to him come out there and saying, oh, how he's opposed to the war and he's opposed to more spending. But, he talks one thing and votes another. And boy, we don't need any more of that in politics, either in Washington or in Madison.
Well, that's the bane of politics, is this bogus substitute for political discourse that's grown up around this high-minded slogans and, you know, fine sentiments and no details, and then they get in there and they just vote for the one-party dictatorship that's really behind everything. And, you know, it's really a sad day for our republic. We've, you know, really reached almost the end of the road, I'm afraid. And fortunately, there are people like you, Ted, waking up and trying to step into the political arena while we still have a political arena.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because it seems more and more like that. With the difficulty of access that we have in getting our message out there and getting covered by anybody, that, I mean, are we really in it, you know?
Right. Well, we're, you know, like I told the people at La Crosse Tribune when they asked if we were, you know, if I was satisfied with, you know, or if I thought that we were talking about things that were, you know, completely irrelevant, that, you know, weren't being picked up, didn't have any traction in the mainstream. I said, no, we're the only ones who are actually saying anything real. And it's all happening on the internet. You know, the actual debate has moved out of the so-called mainstream media and onto the internet. Hey, we do have a caller, and he's been waiting very patiently, so let's go ahead and bring him on. It's Carl from Montreal. How are you, Carl?
I'm doing all right, doing the same as usual, still up here in this never-ending predicament, but I'm hoping that you have some success for the election coming up and get some of these people, you know, kicked out who haven't done anything but lie and lie themselves with corruption, you know. I'm just wishing
you. Thanks, Carl. I appreciate it.
And I was listening to another show today, and they were talking about what happened to bin Laden. You know, he hasn't turned up, you know, like the last
election. Some have been forgotten.
Yeah, and they were talking about one of the shows I heard about making a fake bin Laden tape, you know, doing it as a joke, you know, like a cave that looked like the White House press room with the bin Laden, the Al-Qaeda flag and the Al-Qaeda logo, making a spoof, you know.
Well, that's pretty much what they've been doing for the past 6 years, isn't
yeah.
it?
I was thinking that maybe somebody, you know, should have taken that idea that somebody should have a contest to make a video, you know, to show how stupid it is, you know, the whole thing, you know, ridiculous.
Well, that's a thought. So, hey, do you have any questions for my guest, Ted Burleson?
No, I'm just wishing you two guys, you know, some success, you know. see some real change, you know.
Well, thank you, Carl, and I wish you some success and some real change in your quest as well. You've been very, very patient, not just waiting on the line in the show, but waiting in that detention center up in Canada due to that persecution by the Secret Service.
Yeah.
I sure hope you'll be out of there and free any time.
I've been hoping so. You know, we showed evidence to the government up here that the U.S. District Attorney, the prosecutors were lying, and it doesn't seem like the Canadian government's very interested in the truth, so I don't know, but I'm hoping something happens soon, you know?
Well, governments tend not to be that interested in the truth, especially the hard truths that threaten their power.
Yeah.
But we'll keep our fingers crossed, and we'll keep praying for you. So, hey, have a good one, Carl.
All right.
Take care.
Good. All right.
Bye-bye. Okay. Yeah, speaking, you know, we're living in a tough time for liberty. You know, Ted, we're both libertarians, and I know libertarians have different ideas about where the biggest encroachments are, but, you know, for me, and maybe it's because I'm an academic, it's speech and writing and thought. You know, that's the basic freedom for me, is the freedom of thought. And if your mind is controlled and you can't express yourself, then, you know, the other freedoms, like the economic freedoms, to me, you know, that's secondary. And we're entering an era where people really are not free to express themselves. Carl's locked up because of political cartoons he drew. There are people who are jailed in Europe for supposed Holocaust denial, and here I was exiled from my teaching job because I questioned the official story of 9/11. And where's the freedom of thought? Maybe Ted can tell me when we come back. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Ted Burleson, libertarian candidate for the state assembly in Wisconsin. He's in the 91st district, in my congressional district, and we shall return. Stick around.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
Welcome back. This is the Dynamic Duo Show. You're listening to GCNLive.com. I'm Kevin Durrett, and I'm talking with Ted Burleson. He's a candidate for the 91st District Assembly seat right there in my congressional district, Wisconsin's 3rd District. And, Ted, we were talking a little bit about freedom issues just before the break. We got a call from somebody who's been locked up for a couple of years now because he drew political cartoons critical of President Bush. It's a long story. We won't get into all the details, but we've had these terrible encroachments on freedom of speech, freedom of thought, the Bill of Rights. As a libertarian, what do you think are the most important freedom issues, in what order, and why?
Well, that might be too long of a question to answer in just a few minutes, but you mentioned that you're an academic, and I am as well, and I think one of the biggest problems that we have in America today is that we're losing not just the freedom to question authority, but the academic ability to question authority. We've reduced the academic standards to the point where we've really got a majority of the society that unfortunately doesn't think for themselves and doesn't question authority. And I would hope to see that change.
Well, I would too. What's the first step? How do you start some momentum back in the other direction towards a better informed populace?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the first step would be, but I think any step would be a good first step, improving and raising our academic standards from the bottom up, from K through 12 all the way up through the university level, I think is
that's
a
actually
necessary step that we need to take.
Absolutely. You know, that is part of my platform. If people go to my website, barrettforcongress.us, and click on the Kevin's position on the issues link, you'll find one of those is for reforming education by making it serious again. People from other countries often notice that our K through 12 and our first 4 years of college are not very impressive. Typically, high school grads in some European countries are better educated than our college grads. And tightening things up a little bit and ending automatic promotion probably would be one step in the right direction.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's also in my platform, and I hope to be able to affect that policy at the state level, whether I win or lose. I think I'm, you know, might be able to work with the ultimate winner of this race, even if it isn't myself. Figure the odds.
Yeah, it's against third party candidates are pretty formidable.
Well, as far as I know, a third party candidate hasn't been elected to a state level office in Wisconsin in something like 60 years. So,
right,
you know, the odds are certainly against us. But you know, hopefully we can still make a little bit of a difference, and that's the one difference. If I could make any difference at all, that'd be the first one I'd want to make, is raising our academic standards.
Well, I'm with you on that, especially having been the victim of an academic witch hunt by people who were utterly ignorant of the issues that they were persecuting me over. I do think that we need to change the whole atmosphere in academia.
I completely agree with that.
It was bad before 9/11. You know, there's all kinds of pettiness, and in fact, you know, I think that the liberal left side of the spectrum, which, you know, claims to be the defenders of the intelligentsia, is actually as responsible for it as their enemies on the religious right, because, you know, those people have dumbed us down through insisting on a bunch of multiculturalism issues in such a way as to actually, you know, break down clear standards and break down actual, you know, discrimination in the good sense, that is, discriminating between two different entities. There's been a real loss of critical thought on the left as well as the right in this country, and especially in academia.
Yeah, that's true. I think we've gone into this mode now where we're focusing too much on making sure that the kids don't feel bad about themselves, rather than actually learning something and progressing in their education. And we decided we were going to do a lot to help the kids with the lowest academic ability keep up, but we haven't done anything for the kids who have higher academic ability to advance and move further and you know, to give them any motivation or drive to pursue that. And I think that's a big mistake. We're really going in the wrong direction in academia.
That's right. And, you know, it was always a little bit that way. The U.S. academic system was originally set up, the public school system was set up to take the children of immigrants and make them happy workers at a, you know, low social level, Americans, but not bright enough to question what was going on and question their relative social deprivation. And so it's always been kind of a you know, dumbed-down melting pot kind of institution. But it also had, you know, it had a better side as well, with a certain amount of disciplined thinking going on. And it seems like it has been on a real downswing since, well, I don't know, the last couple of decades at least.
I would agree with that, probably even longer.
Yeah, where do you teach, by the way?
I don't teach. I'm a student at Winona State University. I'm a senior. I'm a physics major, and I do supplemental instruction for astronomy there.
Really? Oh, cool.
I'm also minoring in history, which is, uh-huh. I think I enjoy that more, but the physics is interesting to me as well in so many ways.
Okay, well, since you have some science background, have you checked into the debates about 9/11 and specifically the alleged fire-induced collapses of three buildings?
You know, I really haven't done my research and homework on that like I probably should, and, you know, maybe after the election's over, I'll get some time to get an opportunity to do that. But I'll tell you one thing about 9/11. I know one entity that was not responsible for 9/11, and that's Iraq. And I have yet to figure out what in the world we're doing there and why we've given more lives there than we're lost on 9/11. That just doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, that's because you have the critical thinking skills to notice the difference between, you know, different groups of Arabs and Muslims. It seems like a lot of people don't, and I think that personally, you know, I've been studying 9/11 for, you know, 5 years now, and I'm quite convinced it was a false flag op, and I think the people that did it knew very well that their constituency wouldn't know the difference. So, you know, just have some alleged radical Muslims who, in fact, you know, the 19 guys they fingered were not Muslims at all, much less radical. And there, you know, 10 of them showed up alive after 9/11. But the point is that just, you know, whip up hatred to legitimize the murder of a group of people. And you have to be very careful about making sure that the people they hate, you know, are perfect matches for the people they're going to have to kill.
Right. We've done that throughout history in America. We've found groups of people to hate for a variety of reasons. Well, probably more so even than just in America, for religious reasons, that was done throughout history, I would say. But, you know, we really need to move past that kind of thing, and I would hope that, well, and I think the key to moving past that is education, so hopefully we can make some progress on that.
And education for a different kind of world. In the past, you know, we have had warfare as a very important central human institution, and in today's world, with the communications we have and with the kind of development of weaponry, I think we have to, you know, relegate warfare to the, you know, the dustbin of history, as it were. And, you know, it's one of those institutions that served its purpose and no longer has a purpose.
Oh, absolutely. But unfortunately, and certainly in America, the military-industrial complex drives too much of our economy. And you can even see it by watching the evolution of Barack Obama's campaign.
Getting ahead of yourself there, Ted.
I think it's probably pretty likely, unfortunately, that he's going to be the one that wins it. But anyway, as his campaign has gone along, he started off very much opposed to war, and now all he wants to do is, you know, move the pieces from one spot on the board to another and keep that military-industrial complex just a-churning along. And until we get rid of that, we're not going to change our policies in America. We really need to work hard to make this change, and hopefully we can make some progress on that soon.
And that's how we have to talk about it, not just ending one war. We need to talk about getting a grip on this fact that we've been largely taken over by the military-industrial complex and their financier backers. You know, Eisenhower was right when he warned us about that in his farewell speech in 1960.
Yeah, he was, absolutely, and we would have been wise to pay attention then, although I think even at that point it may have been too late.
Indeed, as the assassination of a president who wanted to radically scale back militarism just a few years later proved. Well, hey, thank you, Ted Burleson. It's been great to have you. Do you have a website?
Yeah, I do. I use a Google site. It's sites.google.com/site/Burleson2008.
Okay, and if people Google Burleson 2008, might they get there?
I hope so.
I hope so, too. Burleson, B-U-R-L-E-S-O-N. Well, thanks, Ted. Hope to have you back on sometime. Good luck in your campaign and your hopeful election.
Good luck to you, too. Thanks for having me.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, the end of the week, so we'll be back on Monday, same time, same channel. Till then, have a great weekend. See you in a bit.